Welcome to the Marketing Society podcast. I'm your host, Mike Pigger, editor at the Society. And for today's pod, I'm pleased to welcome Aaron Shields, Executive Strategy Director at Lander & Fitch, and Paul Graham. Paul is he's a Marketing Society board member, and he was previously Marketing and Comms Director at Moët Hennessy and CMO at Versace and VP of Creative Media and Marketing at Burberry. Welcome to both of you.
Hi. Hello.
Sorry for the speed intro there. I was going to go for the pronunciation of, I believe it's, isn't it Moët?
It's Moët, yes. It's like yeah. Wet. Yeah,
Moët. Yeah, but nobody says that. So everyone just says Moët. No,
yeah, no, everyone in Britain gets it wrong.
Because we're idiots, yeah. not as cultured as some perhaps, but okay. I'm going off topic already. Right. Today, we're going to be talking about retail futures and kind of the future of retail. And I kind of want to start with something that you sort of said off camera or off record, Aaron, recently. And you were sort of saying that COVID's kind of accelerated a lot of trends that were already happening. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's a big deal, isn't it? It's one of these things that's called a black swan event. But I guess the thing that we've noticed at Lander & Fitch is that it's not fundamentally changing the way that people are behaving over the long term. But what it is absolutely doing is fast forwarding that change in behavior that's already sort of underlying. So I guess if you look at an example like China, I guess if you look to the future, or always look sort of east, when they went through SARS, that created a massive surge toward online and is kind of credited with giving birth to, brands like Alibaba. But I think what you can argue is that the trend toward online was certainly there, and kind of the march from like disorganized retail to organized retail, and, online being a massive beneficiary of that. But it certainly accelerated that online trend and, catapulted brands like Alibaba in, into the sort of the face of the country for retail. But I guess some things remain the same. Yeah, they remain constant, like a love for brands and a love for shopping. And thank goodness, because that's what we do.
Do you think that there's definitely an element of kind of retail therapy this year in terms of people being stuck at home and not necessarily having anywhere to go or anything to do, but they're kind of using it as an outlet and an escape?
Oh my God, yeah. I mean, I think enter COVID and everyone is going online for kind of weird things like having drinking and after hours socialization on Zoom. I think I never really sort of got over that. But it's one of the things that we're sort of noticing now is we definitely need retail therapy now more than ever. But when you go online, you can get inspiration, you can get fun. I think that's true. Most of that is found on social media, Instagram, etc. But actually when you go to branded.com sites, they're not nearly as fun as people want. So if you think about visiting a sport apparel store, say a big sort of retailer in London, it's online equivalent is a pale comparison. I mean, online is basically the world's biggest convenience store, maybe the biggest store, but not the best. So I think what this crisis has sort of brought attention to is looking at brands and their .com sort of channel and seeing how we can have more fun, not just being convenient.
And I mean, somebody wrote a piece on our site, and well, actually for our publication in Power an issue or two ago, where they, I think it was about Roblox or however you call it, the platform there. And sort of one of the points they made about it was saying that the version of the internet that we have now is not necessarily the version that we're going to have forever. It's just what people expect. And I'm not saying that we're going to leapfrog straight there straight away, but yeah, like you say, you might get this exciting version of in-store or something with retail, whereas you go to a lot of retailer sites and actually it's still very much a static kind of buy our stuff or go away, and there's not much flair to it. What do you think, Paul?
Yeah, I completely agree with everything that Aaron was just saying, and it strikes a chord with me as well. I mean, one of my biggest experience with sort of like dealing with innovation and progress and change behavior at the same time as the like massive retail footprint obviously was at Burberry, where actually the number of stores that we had plus the sort of brand sort of expectation to be very digital, very entertaining, and always sort of like trying to do things in a new way, there's almost a fault line or certainly a tension between those two things. And actually I think the lessons that that either I learned or certainly sort of were embedded from stuff I already sort of believed was that there are two like core behaviors or two needs that like most companies need to sort of satisfy with customers. And they seem to think that one is done in real in like retail space and one is done online, and that's inspiration and entertainment versus function and sort of transaction. And actually, if you don't do both of them, I think in both spaces, then I think you miss a trick, or you certainly start to lose out. And I think our flagship store on Regent Street was an old cinema and was like, had the biggest digital screen for a while, at least in Europe, if not the world, at one point. But even for all of its trickery and all of its inspiring stuff, actually, it needed to actually do what it was supposed to do. It needed to be just as functional, and vice versa. Actually, the more that we put as much of our interesting content and efforts into making the website as cool and as interesting and as engaging as it could be, actually the two channels rose up and helped each other, I think. COVID has taken its first couple of retail casualties this week, which is sad news for the staff, but I think just only embeds that that issue, which is if you're caught in the middle between thinking that you can either pilot high and just like transact, or you can be a fancy big sort of inspirational store like the apparel store that Aaron was alluding to. If you think you can operate somewhere in the middle and just sort of have an easy life, I think COVID's caught you out. You were going to be caught out anyway. It's just sort of made it happen quicker.
Is there also a thing of not necessarily operating somewhere in the middle between the two? It's almost like a mediocre version of both, but like kind of an amped up version of both. So for example, online, it might be lots of fancy inspiration or, on your website, et cetera. But then when you get to the transactional part of online, it's very formal and boring and transactional. And there's no sort of inspiration or excitement at the part at which you're, potentially parting with your money, giving your details. It all becomes quite boring then. And you go into your rational side of brain, maybe.
Yeah, absolutely right. It really helps. It signals to the brain that this is the moment, this is important, and this is serious. And actually, implies trust and credibility as well, that it sort of just suddenly becomes very businesslike. It still has to be smooth and unnoticeable, and the sort of move between the two needs to be as swift and easy as possible. But yeah, the shift is definitely important.
It's a really interesting kind of like, I think Paul's absolutely right. There's kind of like some moments where you need to be friction free, and there's some moments where you really need to create like emotional friction, like something that a really positive kind of friction. We did a big study with WorldPay a couple of years ago now, but what we discovered is if you want to be remembered, and that's what we all sort of want to be, because when you get remembered as a brand, conversion goes up, advocacy goes up, and repeat visits go up. But to create that memory, you need to have two sort of emotional peaks in a journey. One somewhere in the beginning and middle, which a lot of retailers are fantastic at, but one somewhere near the end. And that is what helps cement the positive memory, a long-lasting memory for that brand. And actually that bit, that's the sort of tough bit. And then you have like, think about a brand like IKEA. We've got lots of like, little peaks sort of along the way, but they put the cheap hot dogs and the ice cream post the cash after that kind of pretty horrible experience at the Tills. But that the reason for that is to sort of leave on a good note.
I mean, what you're talking about is storytelling and three act structure, pretty much, isn't it? You start and you build in the first act and it's all exciting, and then you might have a lull in the middle, and then you build to the climax third act. And then, like you say, you almost have the denouement where it's like the sort of sweet finish wrapping it up with IKEA there. I think we had Jeremy Waite at IBM talked a lot about this, and how like at any kind of stage of what a brand does, you need to tell stories and not stop doing that. Even if you think it's an area where you shouldn't tell a story, for example, because that's just how we're built.
I think you have to think in two ways. You have to think a lot more like a film producer or a film director these days. And what is the kind of the ultimate story, or if you want to use like retail or marketing language, what's the journey that we want to create for that customer. And I think it's also, you have to think a little bit more like a game designer these days, because it's not like, you know, the journeys aren't linear, right? So it's almost, you know, where are the forks in the road in that journey that customers can sort of head off into, and how do you give them an amazing sort of peak instead of a cul-de-sac at each one of those the branches?
I want to pivot slightly to kind of talk about the future of cities at this point, and sort of retail and high streets and things like that. I'm kind of fascinated by the fact that the world might rebuild itself in a way, and sort of what part brands are going to play in that. You know, because the version, again, a bit like the version of the internet, the version of cities that we have now might not necessarily be the version of cities and high streets that we have in the future. You know, if they refashion themselves in different ways, and maybe workers don't come back to offices as much in the same kind of way, what sort of changes do you think we'll see in those kind of areas? I mean, what would you like to see if you were sort of doing kind of future thinking stuff?
Do you want me to answer that? I'll take that first. So the
whoever wants to answer.
It's a big, gives me time to mull. It's a massive question.
It's, yeah, they're big questions, but I think that's why it fascinates me.
I mean, this is one of the biggest shifts that we're seeing. So, you know, we're constantly being asked to, like, how do you reformat and repurpose and sort of rearrange the channel strategy? But I think at the core of it lies something that we think is going to come true, which is, and even though this changes by region, but in the EU anyway, all the surveys that are sort of coming back are telling us that we're heading toward a three-day week in the office. So this whole kind of like center periphery dynamic looks like it's going to be reversed, which is slightly mad. So now most of our time is going to be spent at or around the home, and the minority of time is going to be spent in the center. And you can see the early shoots of this, because like some studies talk about the high street being up as much as 45% compared to pre-COVID times. So in a funny way, like the pandemic, as awful as it is almost like been the savior of many high streets. And by contrast, you know, brands like Pret are taking a hammering in city center locations. So I don't think these offices, if you like, are going to be repurposed anytime soon, because there's no one waiting in their place to pay the same rents. I think what's much more likely is that we'll sort of see rents and rates drop in areas of high concentration as landlords and local councils sort of, you know, move to try and make themselves more attractive. But I think, you know, retailers that support those office areas, again, sort of office dense areas, we'll see a steady decline in the business. So it's a pretty dark picture as far as those areas go. But I think on the other hand, like the sort of dense shopping destinations at the core of, you know, big cities are likely to fare much better, you know, when we see a return of like weekend fun seekers and tourists sort of springing back after the pandemic.
I mean, what about like big department stores? Because obviously, I think Debenhams gone down now, or they're out of the picture. But, you know,
certainly on its way. Yeah.
So Debenhams, you know, I guess John Lewis closed their flagship joint store in Birmingham a while ago. And it's kind of, are those giant sort of stores that are almost like mini towns inside? I mean, I wonder if those are kind of, they'll be sort of devolved into smaller versions, perhaps. You know, will they try and, because I was reading, like, it was a while ago, I think it was Waterstones did like local high street shops, like bookshops, but they didn't brand them Waterstone. So they tried to fit into the high street. So it felt like a lot more localized, to the point where people don't even know it's a Waterstones, you know? I wonder if it'll be like that.
Yeah, that's where, when I mull it, that's sort of, I start to go in that direction for a couple of reasons. One, I think even if the structures can't change, or certainly will be slow to change, I think usage cases will change. So like the big sort of expensive real estate in downtown or central urban areas won't necessarily be able to be sustained the way it is, and it won't have as much footfall. So the things that will make it still valuable to afford will be, I guess, back to sort of more inspirational. So I think those 3 days in the office will be spent more around the big sort of like creative meetings, or the sort of set pieces, or even just moments to gather together and inspire each other. So that might be in a slightly more like different, like internal office environment. And therefore, I think the same happens with how retail companies can both like afford to be in different spaces, but then still service the sort of like disparate like consumer base where they are. And I know we'd started to play with this at Burberry. We never actually managed to put it off, but New York's quite a hard place to run retail, as you can imagine, for all sorts of reasons. But it started to devolve out of Manhattan. And the classic sort of thing we were trying to play with was delivery times. Could you get them within an hour in New York rather than a day or like whatever else? Could you use drones or even Ubers, to be honest, in and around the city? But then there was the whole thing we were starting to talk about is like, well, maybe actually given the traffic in New York, and that there is a reason to this, I'll promise. And even the sort of like the almost cliched like moans about the like afternoon spent in a traffic jam on the way to the Hamptons or back, was whether or not to actually bother with the central store and have it more as a hub for little mini sort of satellite stores, which were where people were and couldn't get about because they were stuck. So there was like, do we have like a little shack in the Hamptons that we can deliver stuff to? So there's like almost very little in the store, so it wouldn't cost very much, and it'd be quite kooky and on the riverfront or on the beachfront. But it would have access to all of the stock and inventory in a sort of cool and probably quite digital screen sort of presented way that could get there in an hour, or could even deliver to the particular like residence that you were staying in for the time, and therefore do the same job of selling from that big sort of like hunk of real estate, but without anyone having to actually go to it. So I think that we'll just have to watch over the next 5-10 years how people play with that. But I think that's it. It's going to be a combination of going all the way up to the top and all the way even more centralized, but servicing lots of little satellites as well, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a super cool time to be in retail, just because, you know, those like fixed tectonic plates are now kind of like sliding and rumbling and creating all kinds of noise. I agree with Paul saying, I think we're seeing a lot of experimentation. We recently launched a new format with a company called Singtel out in Singapore. And that's basically using unmanned formats to come in and, you know, pick up a new phone, discover, you know, touch that phone before you buy it. You know, it sort of lets you in through, you know, facial scans and, you know, personal ID. You can communicate to customer service agents on screens right away. So you still have that connection to a human being. So it's kind of like unmanned, but still human, if that makes sense.
Yeah, totally. We had a lot of success with a similar thing, which is, again, when the Regent Street like flagship was not as busy as it potentially was expected to be, just because it's an absolute, it's like almost like a cruise ship. It's so large. But there were lots of very well educated, trained up staff who were like our flagship staff as well. Actually, what we started to do was, because they were all armed with iPads, they would take our VIP customer contact calls from all around the world as well. And that was actually there for a way of weirdly being more cost effective, but actually doing a better job of two different things at the same time. I think there'll have to be a lot of that. I think a lot of thinking around the problem and not being about geography, but being about the end role or the end user or customer. Yeah. I guess,
you know, at the end of it, it's becoming like a lot more complicated, right? Which I think is actually what is the sort of death knell for department stores. And I mean, you can make the argument that they're kind of like, you know, killed themselves through, you know, lack of action fast enough. But I don't think they're a dead model as a business. It's just, it's way more complicated to measure or to manage because of the consumer trends that are much faster. You know, people are shopping more often, they have higher expectation and generally know more about the products than the retailer. And if you multiply that by all the departments in a department store and then add on like, you know, increasing rents and rates, you need to be super savvy in order to, you know, adjust to those changes. So you do have like, I think, you know, retailers like Selfridges, but I think also retailers like John Lewis, you know, they're a client of ours, but also Walmart, another client, who are like, you know, really on it and came into the game early, as opposed to sort of waited a bit too late to manage all that complexity.
I have two more complications for you as well, just to add to headaches. Obviously COVID, and I know there's, you know, vaccine light at the end of the tunnel and that kind of stuff, but it's not to say COVID-20 won't happen in a couple of years' time. You know, like, we don't know if there's going to be, I'm sure they'll be right, let's do everything differently, but humans are humans. And there's a good chance that, you know, there will be another thing like this in the future, whether it's a few years or 10 years time. And it's, I think if you're stupid, if you don't plan for a world where you're going to have to be socially distanced or, you know, touchless retail and things like that. And then the other headache is climate change stuff. So obviously consumers being way, way more savvy, perhaps especially in 2020, thinking about their impending doom of how do we, you know, protect the planet, and how do we not go back to, I don't know, potentially fast fashion where, you know, you're just getting stuff, sending it back again, you know, it's really wasteful. I don't know, there was a thing the other day about reuse, repurpose, reinvent rather than just throw away. Mm-hmm. And that was really interesting. They were just, it was a long copy thing. It just said re, but it made a good point of like, we need to start using the same thing again and reimagining it.
Yeah. Also, this year we hit our reduction in carbon emissions as a target for the first time, only because none of us were traveling. And you know, the sheer amount of human endeavor that was related to carbon emissions, like, suddenly disappeared overnight, here and in China and various other places. So we actually, to keep to the like target of 2050 or whatever we've got of like zero carbon emissions, we need to keep the reductions at the rate that we've surprisingly got to this year. So there is definitely a big change that has to happen for everyone's behavior and sort of like habits, whether we like it or not, I think. And I think you're right, this is a good impetus. We now have to keep it up. And I think the smart models, the clever companies will be the ones that find ways to help that happen and get there first or innovate, rather than get sort of like dragged along with the tide, as it were. And I think that's the way the world works. But I think that I was maybe lucky enough, or on my best days, I'll claim that it was a little bit of insight as well. But I was one of the first in certainly in my industry and my sector to sort of be like warning that digital was going to change all our lives the last time it did. And I think it still is, but some people are still just about getting with the digital program this time. But I get that same sort of like heckles on the back of my neck, or the sort of like that. I don't know, sort of spidey sense that sustainability is the next digital, and it's already coming. So I think if any of us learned anything from or did well out of sort of the digital transformation that everyone had to go through, I think being first to doing it in the similar way for sustainability is only going to help and only going to see right by people.
I think the good news is that it's never been more important to people. So we're, you know, constantly going to market and asking people about how their behaviors are going to change, or how they think their behaviors are going to change post-COVID. And the one thing that keeps on coming back is that people are generally going to be more considerate with their purchases. They're going to sort of think about their purchases more. And like, some of that materializes in like, you know, I'm thinking about an electric vehicle more. I'm thinking about installing solar panels more. Think about changing my electricity provider, sort of keeping in that same sector. But it's also like, I've started visiting, you know, vintage now more often. And, you know, vintage is set to be the, you know, the biggest growth in fashion over the next decade. So, you know, I think the interesting thing is you've got a consumer demand that's out there. And equally, I think you've got big brands that are waking up to the fact that sustainability doesn't just mean doing less harm against the 20 odd measures that the UN has put out. It's about using it as a platform, and maybe like a seed for innovating. And I think that's where, you know, the big brands the ones that have sort of shown the way, like Adidas and their Parley program, they're showing that this is about innovation. They're finding sort of new ways to manufacture products. And people are getting really excited about it and want to be a part of that that change.
Yeah, I mean, our brand of the year recently got voted for by our members was BrewDog. And I think part of that, the way that they sort of set up, and we said, you know, this is what they've done this year. And part of that was all of their sustainability drive, you know, that people might not agree with how they necessarily go about things sometimes, but you know, they're planting a whole forest in Scotland. They're calling it a BrewDog forest, and they're sort of trying to be, I guess, punk rock about climate change and in terms of you know, I suppose proactively doing something rather than just you know, saying we're going to stop doing stuff, you know. Yeah.
I think that's the, it's the activity and the kind of like actions, not words, that's really important. But you bring up another interesting point, which is more around like community. And it's a, like a central brand question for us at Lander and Fitch. I think the, you know, we're constantly looking for more authentic brands. Like brands used to be just a seal of quality, and now they're kind of some sort of badge of purpose, right? And, you know, customers can like sniff out inauthentic, right? And for me, like this whole shift of like from the core to the periphery, from, you know, from where people work to where people live, is almost like a gift for brands, because, you know, community and the notion of like being embedded in a community is the best way to connect brands to fans. It's like the easiest way, you know. Everybody knows about that forest planted in Scotland. It's not planted somewhere else in the world, you know. It's a sort of local effort. So if you're like, it doesn't matter whether you're a bank, a bookstore, sport retailer, having a connection with the community brings relevance and it brings authenticity. So I think it's a very cool opportunity for brands. If you mix that with sustainability, you've got like, you know, double hit.
I was talking about this a while ago with like Monzo and GIFGAF and stuff. You know, they've been doing it for a long time, that community. Sorry, Paul, what were you going to say?
I was just going to build on what Aaron had just said. But I think as well as all the benefits he was just talking about, I think it, certainly from my angle of having worked in like luxury or sort of the more expensive end of consumerism for the last decade, it actually adds worth. And I mean worth in terms of financial worth, but also sort of perceived like inherent worth. And I think that's a good thing too.
I mean, it's funny because I mean people don't want that one size fits all approach as much as they used to. So you can't like, you know, if you're a bank, don't talk to me about a small business loan. Talk to me about how you get my property development business to the next level and how you help Susan down the road for me. You know, if you're like a sport apparel brand, you can't just talk about Messier anymore. You know, you want to talk about him, but you need to speak about my local football team as well. You know, Dulwich Hamlet in this case. Go people.
Dulwich Hamlet. Yeah.
I think we've done a few sort of themes at the site, like around creativity and collaboration and, you know, activism and purpose. But I think community was a really interesting one. I think that is, again, a lot of articles we've had this year, of some of the most powerful ones or the most well-read ones have been around that. And it's kind of, how do you unlock that power, you know, whether it's a socially distanced thing in the future, or if it's just general, just you know, whether pre or post pandemic, there's no reason to say that it can't be for any type of business. You know, banks can do it, insurance companies can do it, and I guess combine that with the climate change, I guess maybe is where you've got your sweet spot. I wanted to kind of sort of bring this conversation to a close with sort of things that excite you guys for next year. Like what would be the sort of I know we probably touched on them already, but the kind of, you know, the main, and everyone hates these kind of questions, you know, your one big tip for next year and all this stuff, but it doesn't have to be a one big tip, but, you know, just things that are on your mind for next year, if you were looking to kind of mine a rich vein, or, you know, find a brave way of doing things, and you think, actually, if I had a focus for maybe the start of next year, where would I want to put my energies?
Shall I go first this time, Aaron, or do you want to?
Yeah, please, Paul. I'll give you something.
I think we have definitely both at least intimated it, but I'm actually going to steal the word. I think it is about there's going to be more than ever than it would have happened anyway because of us being so disparate and sort of like not together this year, that community is going to be a big thing. People are going to be desperate to commune in whatever sense that is, whether it's still virtually but in better ways, or actually physically again whenever they can, and brands and ideas that sort of steal the march on that and make that possible more deeply and in more like important, significant ways, I think is where I'll certainly be like putting my tip if I had to. And I think if I had to raise a sharp bat, I think it would be, again, in this sense of starting to sort of get ahead of the idea of sustainability. And really, I think that hopefully in the next 12 months, there'll be at least a couple of humdinger, like clever startups or ideas where someone manages to nail what looked impossible before, which was how to give us what we want, but do it in a way that actually is good for the planet, not just doesn't harm it, I think. And if that does happen, then that they'll get all the attention they deserve, I think.
Mm. Yeah, nice, Paul. Totally agree with that. I think maybe just to build a little bit on that is, I think it's a chance like we haven't really had in the past, because there hasn't been a crisis like this. Like I spoke before, like there's a lot of like introspection going on. And I think this, you know, maybe another trend that we sort of talk about, it's been around for a long time, is this sort of steady shift from, you know, consumerism, blind consumerism, to much more consideration around what we buy, you know, what we put in our mouths and our bodies, and how we treat the planet. And it's this, like this rare moment where you can take a stand for something and you can connect to people what really care about, you know, like their passion points, as we sort of call them. And I think that's sort of fascinating. And it's all happening at this time of like crazy technology advances. Like, you know, when I think about, you know, what autonomous cars will sort of do to logistics, you know, Paul already mentioned what, you know, how we can sort of deliver through Uber, but what happens when that gets, you know, automated? What's going to happen to logistical chains? It's not for next year, but it's for soon. You know, how is like personalization and geolocation going to get us closer to communities? You know, how, if we combine machine learning with generative content, like how are we going to, you know, create brand communications in the future, and who's going to win? You know, what about subscription? how much of our spending is going to be subscribed? And, you know, are we going to sort of feel pressure on like what our free purchases are, and how is our thinking around that going to change? Because if everything's automated, then am I having as much fun as I want? You know, it's like all of these sort of technology things are happening at the same time as, you know, that big P word, purpose. And it's going to be fascinating to see how they combine.
I think you mentioned the F word as well, fun, actually. I think that most things win out. They, even if they're right, if they sound worthy, they don't ever catch on as like as a groundswell of sort of activity. I think the minute that they feel fun or cooler than like the other stuff, I think that's when that we'll finally see it flip as well. So purpose with fun, I think, is a good combination.
Yeah, I think almost like fun over purpose in that sense. But we had we almost discovered it by accident, but we were running some shopper intercepts, like thousands of them. And what we found was if the experience was perceived as fun, it was more powerful than any other part of the offer, like better price or range or good service or anything like that. If it was fun, it moved NPS, Net Promoter Score, bigger or more than any other sort of factor in the experience. So let's have some fun next year.
I think you guys have brought it back to storytelling again, because I can't remember. It's a very famous director whose name escapes me, but they basically said, again, if you can make an audience laugh, you're actually onto a winner far more than a drama or anything else. You've got them. And they'll come out saying, actually, I had a really good time. And, you know, like you say, people, that sort of triumphs almost anything else, making people feel good. A good place on which to end, I think. Thanks very much, guys. Really good discussion. And yeah, look forward to seeing what happens next year. And I'm pretty sure most of your predictions are on the money, and that's how it's going to go. So be really excited to see how it develops.
Cheers, mate.
Thanks, guys.